Chapter 9. Cale had to push his way through throngs of human beings in order to enter the Penny Palace. The size of the crowds encouraged him. In this mass of money-hungry humanity, he would be like a piece of driftwood in a vast ocean. He did not hesitate. He had looked over the games earlier, and he headed straight toward the one he wanted for his final bid for fortune. It would be important, he thought, to gain a playing position and stick to it. The new game paid odds as high as 100-1 and as low as 5-1. It worked in a comparatively simple fashion, though Cale, who knew something of the energies, having worked in his father's shop since before he was 15, realized there was electronic intricacy behind the deceptive appearance of alertness. A ball of force was the core. It was about an inch in diameter, and it rolled erratically inside a larger plastic ball. Faster, 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 it darted over the inner surface, until its speed transcended the resistance of matter. Then, like the pure force it was, it burst the limitations of its prison. Through the plastic it plunged, as if there were nothing there, as if it were a beam of light that had been imprisoned by an unnatural physical law in an almost invisible cage. And yet the moment it was free, it grew afraid. It changed color, subtly, swiftly, and it slowed. Its speed of escape must have been miles a second, but so great was its fear that it stopped completely after traveling less than 3 feet. It began to fall, and until the moment of fall, until it almost touched the table, it gave an illusion of being everywhere. It was an illusion entirely inside the minds of the players, a product of enormous velocity and mental hallucination. Each player had the conviction that the ball was flying straight toward him, that when it fell, it would fall into the channel he had activated with a number. It was inevitable that the majority of the gamblers were due for disappointment when the ball, its mission accomplished, dropped into a channel and activated the odds mechanism. The very first game in which Cale participated paid him 37 credits for his one. He raked in his winnings with an attempt at casualness, but the shock of victory overflowed along his nerves in spasms of excitement. He placed a credit card in 4 channels, lost, then bet the same numbers again and won 90 credits. During the next hour, he won on an average 1 in 5 times. He recognized that his luck was phenomenal, even for him, and long before the hour was up, he was risking 10 credits in each channel that he played. At no time did he have an opportunity to count his money. At intervals, he would thrust a handful of credits into the automatic changer and receive large bills, which he would press into an inner pocket. Not once did he draw on his reserves. After a while, he thought in a curious panic, I must have 3,000 or 4,000 credits. It's time to quit. It's not necessary to win the whole 5,000 in one night. I can come back tomorrow and the day after, and day after that. It was the speed of the game that confused him. Each time the impulse came that it was time to think of stopping his play, the ball would start to whirl, and he would hastily drop money into several channels. If he lost, irritation would come, and a greedy determination not to leave behind even a penny of his winnings. If he won, it seemed ridiculous to stop in the middle of the most amazing streak of luck that he could ever hope to have. Wait, he told himself, till he lost 10 in a row. 10 in a row. 10. Somewhere along there, he had a glimpse of a wad of 40,000 or 51,000 credit notes, which he had put in his side pocket. There was more money in other pockets, and again, without being more than blurrily aware of the fact, he would strew large bills at random in various channels. How much, he couldn't remember. Nor did it matter. The machine always counted accurately and paid him the right odds. He was swaying now like a drunken man. His body seemed to be floating above the floor. He played on in an emotional mist, almost oblivious of others. He did become conscious that more and more players were riding his luck, calling up his numbers in their own channels. But that was unimportant and personally meaningless. He did not come out of his daze until the ball plunked down like a dead thing in its cage. He stood stolid, waiting for the game to begin again, unaware that he had anything to do with its stopping until a plump, dark man came forward. The stranger said with an oily smile, Congratulations, young man. We welcome your patronage. We are happy for you, but for these other ladies and gentlemen, we have bad news. The rules of this house, which are conspicuously posted in our fine establishment, do not permit luck riders, as we call them. This fortunate young man's trend of luck has been definitely established. Henceforth, all other bets must be placed before the winner makes his choice. The machine has been set to react accordingly. So do not cause yourself disappointment by making a last-second wager. It will not work. And now, good luck to all of you, and especially to you, young man. He waddled off, still smiling. A moment later, the ball was whirling again. It was during the third game that Cale thought out of nothingness, "Why, I'm the center of attention." It startled him. He had come out of that oblivion on which he had counted to maintain his security. "I'd better slip out of here as quietly as possible," he thought. He turned from the table, and a pretty girl threw her arms around him, pressed tightly against him, and kissed him.
"Oh, please let me have some of your luck. Please, please."
He disentangled himself blankly, the original impulse forgotten.
"I was going to do something," he remembered, and laid several bets while he frowned over the elusive memory.
He was aware that newcomers were jostling up to the table, sometimes forcibly crowding out the less resourceful and determined of those who had been there first. Once, when he noticed a particularly violent ejection of a vociferously protesting player, the warning thought ticked again in his head that he and this table were now plainly marked by 1,000 avid eyes. He couldn't recall just what it was he wanted to do about that. There seemed to be a lot of women around, plucking at him with their fingers, kissing him if he turned his head, and he had a sense of an overabundance of their perfume. He couldn't move his hands without a woman's bare skin being available for his touch. Naked arms, naked backs, and dresses cut so low in front that he was constantly having his head drawn down into soft, daintily perfumed bosoms. When he bent an inch for a natural reason, the ever-present hands pulled him the rest of the way. And still the night in his luck did not end. He had a sense of too much pleasure, too much applause at every spin, at every win. And whether he won or not, women flung themselves into embraces with him, and either kissed him commiseratingly or in a frenzy of delight. Wild music played in the background. He was 23 years old, and the attack on every sense of his body overwhelmed his caution. When he had won uncountable thousands of credits, the doors of the Penny Palace closed, and the roly-poly man came over and spoke curtly. "All right," he said. "That's enough. The place is cleared of strangers, and we can stop this nonsense." Cale stared at him, and the clock of danger was ticking so loudly that his whole brain hummed with the sound. "I think," he mumbled, "I'll go home." Somebody slapped his face, hard. "Again," said the plump man. "He's still riding an emotional jag." The second blow was harder. Cale came out of his haze with the sharp comprehension that he was in deadly peril. "What's going on here?" he stammered. His eyes appealed to the people who had been cheering him only minutes before, the people whose presence had lulled him. It was impossible that anything would be done against him while they were around. He whirled on the plump man, and then stood rigid as rough hands grabbed him and rougher hands probed in the pockets of his clothes, relieving him of his winnings. As from a great distance, he heard the plump man speak again. "Don't be naive. There is nothing unusual about what has happened. All the regular players have been squeezed out, not only out of the game, but out of the building. The 1,000 people in here now are hired for such occasions and cost us 10 credits each. That's only 10,000 altogether, and you won from 50 to 100 times as much as that." He shrugged. "People don't realize the economics of such things. Next time, don't be so greedy." He smiled an oily smile. "That is, if there is a next time." Cale found his voice. "What are you going to do?"
"You'll see." His voice went up. "All right, men, take him to the truck plane and we'll open up again."
Cale felt himself irresistibly hustled across the room and into a dark corridor. He was thinking in despair that, once again, he had put himself into a position where other men decided his fate. Interlude. McAllister, reporter from 1951, realized that he was lying on a sidewalk. He climbed to his feet. A group of curious faces gawked at him, and there was no park, no magical city of the future. Instead, a bleak row of one-story shops made a dull pattern on either side of the street. A man's voice floated toward him out of a blur of other sounds.
"I'm sure it's the reporter who went into that weapon shop."
So he was back in his own time.
perhaps even the same day. As he moved slowly away, the same penetrating voice said, "He looks kind of sick. I wonder what..." He heard no more, but he thought, "Sick? These people would never understand how sick." But somewhere on Earth must be a scientist who could help him. The record was that he hadn't exploded. He was walking rapidly now and clear of the crowd. Once he looked back and saw that the people were dispersing in the aimless fashion of folk who had lost their center of interest. McAllister turned a corner and forgot them. "I've got to decide." The words were loud, close. It took a moment to realize that he had spoken them. Decide? He hadn't thought of his position as requiring a decision. Here he was. Find a scientist. If that was a decision, he had already made it. The question was, who? Memory came of his old physics professor at City College. Automatically, he turned into a phone booth and fumbled for a nickel. With a sickening sense of disaster, he remembered that he was dressed in an all-enclosing, transparent suit, and that his money was inside. He drew back, then stopped, shaken. What was happening? It was night in a brilliant, glowing city. He was standing on the boulevard of an avenue that stretched jewel-like into remote distance. It was a street that flamed with a soft light gleaming up from its surface, a road of light, like a river flowing under a sun that shone nowhere else, straight and smooth. He walked along for uncomprehending minutes, fighting a wild hope, but at last the thought forced through to his consciousness. Was this again the age of Isher and the gunmakers? It could be. It looked right, and it meant they had brought him back. After all, they were not evil, and they would save him if they could. For all he knew, weeks had passed in their time. He began to hurry. Find a weapon shop. A man walked by him, and McAllister turned and called after him. The man paused curiously and looked back, then continued on his way. McAllister had a brief picture of dark, intense eyes, and a visualization of a person on his way to a marvelous home of the future. It was that made him suppress his impulse to run after the man. Afterwards, he realized he should have. It was the last person he saw on all those quiet, deserted streets. It must have been the in-between hour before the false dawn, and no one was aboard. Oddly, it was not the absence of human life that disturbed him. It was the fact that not once did he see a weapon shop. In spite of that, his hope mounted. Soon it would be morning. Men would come out of these strange, glowing homes. Great scientists of an age of wizard scientists would examine him, not in a frenzy of haste, with the fear of destruction hanging over their heads, but quietly, in the sanity of super laboratories. The thought ended. He felt the change. He was in the center of a blinding snowstorm. He staggered from the first mighty, unexpected blow of that untamed wind. Then, bracing himself, he fought for mental and physical calm. The shining, wondrous night city was gone. Gone also the glowing road. Both vanished, transformed into this deadly wilderness world. He peered through the driving snow. It was daylight, and he could make out the dim shadows of trees that reared up through the white mist of blizzard less than 50 feet away. Instinctively, he pressed toward their shelter and stood, finally, out of that blowing, pressing wind. He thought, 1 minute in the distant future, the next, where? There was certainly no city. Only trees and uninhabited forest and a bitter, primeval winter. How long he stood there while those winds blew and that storm raged, he had no idea. He had time for 1,000 thoughts, time to realize that the suit protected him from the cold, as there was no cold. And then the blizzard was gone, and the trees. He stood on a sandy beach. Before him stretched a blue, sunlit sea that rippled over broken, white buildings. All around, scattered far into that shallow, lovely sea, far up into the weed-grown hills, were the remnants of a once tremendous city. Over all clung an aura of incredible age, and the silence of the long dead was broken only by the gentle, timeless lapping of the waves. Again came the instantaneous transition. More prepared this time, he nevertheless sank twice under the surface of the vast, swift river that carried him on and on. It was hard swimming, but the insulated suit was buoyant with the air it manufactured each passing second. and after a moment he began to struggle purposely toward the tree-lined shore 100 feet to his right. A thought came, and he stopped swimming. What's the use? The truth was as simple as it was terrible. He was being shunted from the past to the future. He was the weight on the long end of an energy seesaw, and in some way he was slipping further ahead and further back each time. Only that could explain the catastrophic changes he had already witnessed. In an hour would come another change. It came. He was lying face downward on green grass. When he looked up, he saw a half dozen low-built buildings on the horizon of grass. They looked alien, unhuman. But his curiosity was not about them. A thought had come. How long, actually, did he remain in one particular time? He kept an eye on his watch, and the time was 2 hours and 40 minutes. This was his last curiosity. Period after period, as the seesaw jerked on, he remained in his one position. Water or land, it made no difference to him. He did not fight it. He neither walked, nor ran, nor swam, nor even sat up. Past, future. His mind was turned inward. He had a vague feeling that there was something he ought to do, inside his skin, not outside. Something about a decision he had believed he must make. Funny, he couldn't recall what it was. Beyond doubt, the gunmakers had won their respite. For at the far end of this dizzy teeter-totter was the machine that had been used by the Isher soldiers as an activating force. It, too, teetered past, then future, in this mad seesaw. But that decision, he'd really have to try to think about it.